doesn't believe in a solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and will continue to act this way even if he's not an opposition leader anymore, or at least supposed to be. Israel's new cabinet held a festive first meeting Sunday night following a historic Knesset vote, with 60 members voting in favor, 59 against and 1 abstaining. Bennett urged his ministers to show restraint over the numerous ideological differences between parties in alliance to ensure its stability. Bennett will serve as prime minister first as part of a rotation agreement with Lapid. He will serve alternately as prime minister and foreign minister until the handover of power to Lapid on 27th of August 2023. Experts warn that in an attempt to prolong the life of the new fragile eight-party coalition, Naftali Bennett, the new Israeli prime minister, will exert every possible effort to appease the most extreme elements, especially through the continuation of settlement activities across the occupied territories. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Ngo Dinh Diem, a pro-American, became president of South Vietnam in 1955 and, with the assistance of the U.S., began to arrest anyone suspected of being a member of the Viet Minh Communist Coalition. The U.S. then gradually increased its troop deployment to the country, fearing that communism would soon spread across the region. In 1964, the Gulf of Tonkin incident gave the U.S. government an excuse to justify a war on Vietnam. An intruding U.S. destroyer clashed with North Vietnamese Navy torpedo boats in August of that year. In an ensuing sea battle, one U.S. aircraft and three North Vietnamese torpedo boats were damaged. Also, four North Vietnamese soldiers were killed. As a result, the U.S. Congress then approved the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which authorized U.S. military action in the region. After a bloody and protracted war, a truce was struck in 1973, ending direct U.S. involvement and completing the evacuation of American forces, which had grown to 500,000. The war claimed the lives of 58,000 Americans and 4 million Vietnamese. It impacted 700,000 American veterans, cost the U.S. more than $100 billion, and tarnished the country's image and morale at home. However, the true narrative behind the Vietnam War was revealed after then-Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara commissioned a secret history based on classified papers, the Pentagon Papers, in 1967. He formed a research team to assemble and analyze Defense Department decision-making dating back to 1945. An analyst on the research, Daniel Ellsberg, eventually disclosed portions of the report to the New York Times, which was published in 1971. The papers revealed that the U.S. had secretly enlarged the scope of its actions in the Vietnam War, with coastal raids on North Vietnam and Marine Corps attacks, none of which were reported in the mainstream media. The Pentagon Papers are an important record of the United States' first defeat in a war. To this day, the United States' failures in the Vietnam War, as well as its atrocities in terms of civilian casualties and the deployment of chemical weapons, have stained America's reputation at home and abroad.
Ashes and rubbles. There is nothing more left as despair has once again taken over Rohingya refugees in New Delhi. A devastating fire has brought down the entire camp to ruins. Around 55 families were residing in the camp. Most of the refugees have escaped unharmed, but all they had has turned into ashes. Now some local NGOs and residents are lending support.
It was around 11:30 in the night yesterday when my children started crying due to the heat of the fire. When I opened my eyes, there was huge smoke and fire. We immediately got out of our shanty and moved to the safety.
The residents of the camp are not sure how the fire started, but an eyewitness said it started in the middle of the camp, and within an hour everything was on ground, and it took the firefighters a lot of efforts to control it. Rights activists have urged the UN Refugee Agency for prompt response in helping them with every possible way.
I don't know why we are facing all this hardship. Our lives are miserable. We can't live in our own country with dignity. And wherever we go for refuge, hardship follows us. I am happy to have my child alive. I can't forget the scene I saw yesterday. Even if I close my eyes, it frightens me.
The camp is surrounded by a cluster of shanties where people from all faiths live. Many people I spoke with had a suspicion that either the fire broke out due to a short circuit or it could possibly be a conspiracy to vacate them from the location, since the deportation campaign to expel Rohingya from India has gained momentum in recent years. The blaze has destroyed everything these people have had. Now they have to brave both the harsh heat of the summer and the fear of the COVID-19 pandemic. Their miseries continue to mount with each passing day. In a display of mercy and compassion, scores of neighboring residents and activists from the NGOs reached the spot to lend whatever help they could. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in India who are now stuck in limbo amid a vicious campaign to deport them. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Muhammad Al-Attar, a Palestinian teacher, has lost his wife and three children in an Israeli airstrike in his house in North Gaza Strip. Muhammad's four-story building that was a shelter for his entire family totally collapsed to the ground. Muhammad, who used to have a normal life, working at a school and looking after his kids, is now homeless and without a family.
Israeli airstrikes hit our building without any prior notice. I just opened my eyes and found all of us under the rubble. Some of us managed to get out of the rubble. I tried to save my children, but to no avail. I called for help from Civil Defense Service, but it took long till they reached us. I just want to ask the international community and human rights groups, what are our rights? I had a peaceful life and suddenly I became homeless without a family. I lost every hope I used to have.
Hassan Al-Attar, Muhammad's father-in-law, has his own sufferings to tell. Working in the civil defense services, he was surprised with a call informing that his daughter, along with her three kids, were killed by Israeli airstrikes. Staring at the bodies of his daughter and her three children, Hassan bid farewell to his daughter while he was at work trying to pull their bodies from the rubble.
I was at work when Muhammad called me to tell that Israel bombed his house and my daughter and her three kids were under the rubble. They weren't ambulances. They were all out on missions and I had to wait for one. When I got to them, their bodies were all out of the rubble. I don't know why Israel targeted them.
Most Gazans are in need of mental health support following the latest 11-day escalation that killed families in their homes in Gaza. The north parts of the Gaza Strip, along with Beit Hanun and Jabalia, was one of the areas that witnessed bombardment coupled with heavy artillery shelling. Hundreds of Palestinians, including women and children, were killed in the Israeli bombardment of the Gaza Strip in 11 days of the conflict that began on May 10. Israel's airstrikes also brought widespread devastation to the already impoverished territory.
Palestinians here say the aggression has not undermined their will to stand against the occupation regime. They say despite their suffering, they will remain steadfast and fight for their rights. Ruba Shavet, Gaza.
Against the racist and Islamophobic far right, in defense of public and individual liberties, that's the main slogan of 140 marches that took place all over France, organized by more than 100 organizations and associations. The protesters say there is an urgency to stop the rise of far right militias and parties in France that act more and more openly and in full impunity.
It's the first time that we see people producing videos with death threats and using real bullets in a killing setup. We didn't realize the nature of the danger that's rising in our country. The day after the video, the president of the republic's been slapped in the face. I think that now many people are aware of the gravity of the situation.
Earlier this year, thousands of militaries, amongst them dozens of generals, openly called for law and order against the danger of Islamization of the French society. Earlier this week, a known far-right activist posted a video where he steps with a knife and shoots with real bullets a puppet representing progressive activists and calling for the murder of journalists and the left leader Mélenchon. One day later, a far-right activist slapped President Macron in the face, shouting a royalist slogan. But instead of facing a danger of a fascist putsch, the French government was occupied in endless debates in Parliament and Senate about separatism, targeting directly the Muslim community, or in voting laws protecting the police.
The French government should be a barrier, but step by step it is becoming a bridge to the far right because the government is introducing in the public debate topics like migration and so-called separatism. There is clearly an authoritarian drift of the government, and all these issues pave the way for the far right.
The far right tries to introduce in France as a unique issue the Muslims and the insecurity. These are not the problems that we face. We face social and health problems. These are the real problems.
Protesters say that an authoritarian and racist drift in the French society is already taking place. This ideology is officially carried by the Marine Le Pen party. Instead of facing this danger, they say the French government is copying parts of the far-right program and is not making any concessions to the popular movement like the Yellow Vest protests. Presidential elections will take place in France in less than 1 year, and the odds of a racist and Islamophobic far-right leader taking the reins remain high. Christian Hunt, Paris.
For the last time, the seven presidential candidates stood toe-to-toe at the headquarters of Iran's national television, the IRIB, to face off for the third and final debate. While the debate was themed with people's concerns, it was derailed every once in a while toward other issues, such as foreign policy, a topic toward which the two camps of the principalists and the reformists have conflicting stances. The debate saw the two pro-reformist candidates, Abdel Nasser Hemati and Mohsen Mehranizadeh, stressing the need for Iran to join the Paris-based Financial Action Task Force, or the FATF, a global intergovernmental organization tasked with combating money laundering and terrorism financing. Iran and North Korea are the only two countries in the world that have not signed up for the FATF.
Mr. Jalili, only you and North Korea are saying that the FATF is useless. Are you saying the 200 countries around the world which signed the FATF do not understand that it's useful or not? The FATF is meant to contain money laundering and terrorism. Please think twice before making any comment.
Saeed Jalili, a heavyweight principalist, called Iran's entrance into the FATF an irreparable mistake that completes the puzzle of sanctions by the West and the U.S.
Entering into some international conventions is a mistake. You agree to enter into the FATF, but then they will decide the next step for you.
But he did not elaborate on his stance during the debate. Along with other journalists, I waited outside the debate studio to investigate his take on the FATF and how he would treat the international convention should he become the next Iranian president.
The Iranian government has already signed an action plan with the FATF. Rouhani has agreed that Iran implement 39 out of the 41 articles of the FATF. Iran did comply with those 39 articles, yet that organization has approved only 16 of them. Furthermore, the FATF has made an announcement that if Iran fulfills the entire 41 articles, still it would define the next step for the country. Iranians need to know about these facts.
As part of Iran's action plan with the FATF, initially agreed upon more than 6 years ago, the country had to finalize four pieces of legislation. Two were passed by a reformist-dominated parliament, but the incumbent principalist-heavy parliament has halted the approval of the two remaining bills and referred them to the arbitration body, the Expediency Council, whose secretary is another presidential runner, Mohsen Rezai. Rezai says any decision regarding the FATF now is tied to whether the U.S. would lift its anti-Iran sanctions as part of the ongoing Vienna talks between Iran and the parties to the nuclear deal over the revival of the 2015 accord. This is how the upcoming presidential election could shape Iran's foreign policy. Iranians will go to polls on June 18th to choose their next president. While many Iranians are still undecided on a single candidate, the debates have helped them to narrow down their choices. But the question of who will be the next Iranian president will be answered on June 18th. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Tomorrow.
marked the 2,000 days of the detention of Sheikh Zazaki, the Islamic movement in Nigeria issued a statement expressing concern over the continuous detention of the Islamic cleric, but most especially the silence of other Nigerians over this injustice. In December 2015, Sheikh Zazaki was arrested by security forces following an attack on his home and worship center, where hundreds of his supporters were killed by soldiers. The statement by the Islamic movement said the silence of those who supposed to condemn the injustice is more painful than the jubilation of the oppressors.
The masses should know that if today is Sheikh Zazaki, tomorrow it may be you. If you are a Christian and the government is detaining the Sheikh, well, you want to kill the Sheikh because he doesn't practice the same ideology in Islam with them, what about you that you are a Christian? You should come out and join hand and fight against injustice and say no to injustice and oppression.
For over 5 years, members of the Islamic movement have been coming out to protest, seeking for the release of Sheikh Zazaki, but the Nigerian government has kept a deaf ear. Over 300 supporters of Sheikh Zazaki were killed and dumped in a mass grave without proper identification and funeral prayers. This and the attack on Sheikh Zazaki and his supporters, according to the Islamic movement, were despicable and unacceptable.
That is the worst that has happened in the history of Africa, where a detachment of army of a country, we launch an attack to an innocent citizen, to his house, is the worst crime against humanity in the history of Africa.
Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki is spending close to 6 years in detention. The Islamic movement in Nigeria called on the Nigerian authorities to comply with the Federal High Court order and release Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zainab. Tanjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
As the G7 descended on Cornwall for the summit, thousands of passionate pro-Palestine protesters amassed outside Downing Street in central London on Saturday to vent their anger over ongoing Israeli crimes against the Palestinians.
These protesters are absolutely furious at the lack of action from world leaders following Israel's recent and relentless attacks on Gaza and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Although a ceasefire has been agreed since then, the fact that Palestinians are still forced to live under an apartheid regime has bitterly fueled the anger of these protesters who want to force a change.
Protesters had various demands, including international recognition of the Palestinian state and an end to Israeli arms sales.
If arms are used in violation of international law, they must be banned, embargoed immediately. Also, the issue of settlement products, they must be banned immediately. Those are illegal products. The recognition of the state of Palestine is long overdue. We do not understand why the UK government is not even listening to the voices of its own people, the voices of its own parliament that voted overwhelmingly to recognize the state of Palestine. The lack of recognition is not only immoral, it is undemocratic.
Place an embargo on Israel. Stop the arms deal. So this is the message that we're sending to. The people are with us. We're in our thousands. And we are going to continue until, honestly, the Palestinians are free and occupation is ended.
We are not going to forget the mark of shame upon the history of this country that brought us to where we are today, the Balfour Declaration. We demand a public apology from the British government as well as recognition of our state of Palestine. On top of that, we want sanctions now. We want justice. We want action.
The bombs may have temporarily stopped falling, but while Israel's systematic discrimination against the Palestinian people continues, so will the protests. Robert Carter, London.
This is IRIB English Radio.
get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we're currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household, and make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
the debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Israeli far-right groups have marched in the occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds. Palestinian protesters have also gathered at the venue of the so-called March of the Flags, which marks the anniversary of Israel's 1967 occupation of the city's eastern sector. Tel Aviv's annexation of East Jerusalem al-Quds during the six-day 1967 war has never been recognized by most of the international community. Israeli forces have cordoned off roads leading to Damascus Gate in the city and arrested a number of Palestinians on the steps of the gate leading to the old city. Now, is this supposed to end up in violence? Stay tuned to Press TV and watch us discuss aspects of the issue with our experts. Let's get an update first. Let's go to Occupy Ramallah. Mona Kendall is there. Mona, over to you. What's going on there?
Well, despite the metal barriers that were erected by the Israeli police in Jerusalem, Al-Quds Old Town, and in the streets leading to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Damascus Gate, Bab al-Amud, however, Palestinians, thousands of them, succeeded to reach Bab al-Amud area, the Damascus Gate, and demonstrated their protested in order to prevent thousands of Israeli settlers who were taking part in Jerusalem flag march. Clashes erupted between the Israeli police who were protecting the settlers. According to paramedics, 33 Palestinians were wounded by the Israeli forces. 17 others were detained by the Israeli soldiers during the clashes that erupted in the Bab al-Amud area. Palestinians sent a clear message that even the Jerusalem flag march, and despite the strict measures, and we are speaking about over 2,000 more Israeli police officers that were deployed in the old town of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and around the Al-Aqsa Mosque in order to protect the settlers' march. However, Palestinians succeeded to reach there and to send a clear message that Jerusalem, Al-Quds, will always be a Palestinian, and that Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islamic, and they will continue to defend it. Israeli forces closed Arab and Palestinian shops in the old town. The streets that around the Al-Aqsa Mosque, like Al-Misrara, Bab al-Sahira, as well as Sultan streets, were completely closed by the Israeli soldiers. The route of the march was changed a lot by the Israeli forces. However, the Israeli settlers did not enter the old town of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and the gate of Bab al-Amud was completely closed. The settlers didn't enter the Bab al-Amud gate in order to enter to the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. However, they marched and celebrated and sang and danced in the complex of Bab al-Amud. However, Palestinians, elderly women, youths were there to confront them despite the strict measures and despite the attack by the Israeli forces who were protecting the settlers. Experts said that that was a challenge for the new Israeli coalition cabinet in case they, for the last moment, they were expecting that the Israeli cabinet would end this protest or would change completely the route of this march, especially after the warnings from the Hamas movement that sent a warning to the Israeli cabinet that if the settlers enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, they would bear the consequences.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Mona Khan and Ramallah. Now, joining me in this debate tonight will be Palestinian activists Amal Wahtan in Ramallah and also professor of media practice and philosophy with Coventry University, Kenneth Hill in London. Good to have you both on the show. Let's go to Occupy Ramallah. Amal, what does this day back in 1967 remind the Palestinians about?
Yes, in 1967, of course, Israeli occupation occupied the rest of Palestine, West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. And for them, in this Jerusalem Day march, they're trying to show off that they were able to unify Jerusalem under the control of the Israeli occupation. And for us Palestinians, it was a Nakba at that time, Nakba in 1948, and it's continued. This Nakba is continuing until now, while the Israeli occupation still seizing our land and killing our people and seizing Gaza. So the Nakba for us continues, and this march today and the show of illusional victory, let's say, that they were able to go on with their flag parade, shows that they have been defeated, because Jerusalem has turned into a military barracks. 20,000 soldiers and policemen were spread in Jaffa Gate and in the streets leading to the old city of Jerusalem. The old city of Jerusalem has turned also into military barracks. They closed all shops, Palestinian shops, and they forced the owners to go to their homes. So the whole city was turned into curfew for the Palestinians, but it was full of soldiers. The marchers themselves, they counted for 22 or 3,000, but the rest of them were Israeli policemen and soldiers. So this show of force shows that the Israelis were defeated today as well, because the Palestinians were demonstrating in all streets leading to the old city of Jerusalem, and that's there were as well confrontations in several areas. So they think that they succeeded in this flag parade, but at the same time, the Palestinians showed their will as well.
All right, now let me ask Professor Farrow, is this the right time for the Israelis to hold such a controversial rally? It's only weeks since a truce to stop the Israeli deadly aggression on Palestinian lands.
Well, I think, as we've seen before, there's a pattern of provocation in situations like this, and that's part of the way that the Israelis have handled the situation externally. We've heard about the military suppression internally. But of course, Israel depends on its position in terms of the international reflection of the actions that it takes. And so it has considered this, and it's allowed this to go ahead. It's created the situation. We have to, of course, repeat the fact that Israel is a settler state. It's a violent occupation. And Palestinians have suffered violence since 1948, and that violence is physical, mental, cultural, and economic. And actions like today, and incidents like today, act towards a kind of humiliation, an attempt to humiliation of the Palestinians. And we know that since 1948, there has been resistance and always been a fight for the right of return. So when people take a position, when Palestinians take a position against Israeli aggressions, every time they do that, they're part of a long history of resistance to occupation. Now, there's always been a political battle for Palestine in the international world, and this is about ideas, about representation, rhetoric, and images. These are all issues. But I think what's happened recently, there's been a shift, there's been a change in favor of Palestine and the Palestinians. And I think this has happened because there was a shift around the notion of Israel as an apartheid state, which has been happening over the past 10 to 15 years. We had the boycotts of Israeli goods, and the notion that Israel and South Africa are similar entities. And this is something which has gained a kind of traction internationally. We know that in every situation, there's always a battle for the hearts and minds of people, and media is a very, very important part of that. We saw this in Vietnam, for example, where the Americans, we know, lost the war. And I think there is that kind of feeling at the moment, in particularly in young people, who all of a sudden have suddenly gained an interest in Palestine. And we've seen it internationally across the world. The TikTok generation are really completely involved and interested in the situation of Palestine. And this is something which is reaching millions and millions of people, over 300 million people on TikTok, talking about Palestine, debating Palestine, and showing concern for Palestine. And I think so whatever happens on the ground in Al-Quds or in Gaza or in the rest of the occupied territories, in Palestine as a whole, is feeding into a much bigger debate, and that debate is really quite radical compared to what we've had over recent years. Okay. Young people are saying that they don't believe in the Oslo Accord, that the Oslo Accord is dead. They're not even believing in the two-state solution. And I think this is a great shift in recent political kind of debates that we've seen, which the media is very importantly feeding into. And of course, that's why Palestinian media is being suppressed today by Israeli authorities. We know that there's been a huge clampdown because they do not want images of suppression to be beamed across the world, because they know that's a losing battle.
Okay. Now, Amal, the new government in Tel Aviv has lent full back into the holding of the March of Flags in this sensitive juncture. It seems that a new prime minister doesn't care much about how the Palestinians feel about this occasion. Let's have your take.
Of course, both governments, the former and the current government, they don't care. They come actually from the same roots. They're both ultra-Zionist, ultra-racist, ultra-Nazis. So both government leaders of the former and the current governments are extremists. So they don't give or they don't care about Palestinian lives. They don't care. The only notion that they care about is Zionist ideology, which is seizing the whole lands of the Palestinians. And that's what we are currently going through inside Jerusalem and the surrounding neighborhoods of Jerusalem, like Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan neighborhoods. Seizing more and more houses and ordering demolishing of houses, of more houses. 638 houses are to be demolished in Silwan. This is ethnic cleansing. So the policy of ethnic cleansing continues since 1948 up until now. Now the Palestinians own only 10% to 12% of their land, while the Israelis are seizing most of the land. It is an apartheid state, and world opinion has changed gradually until last month, when they were more convinced that this apartheid state has to be stopped, that has to be dismantled. If we want to reach peace and security and prosperity in this region and for the whole world as well, this apartheid state must be dismantled, and a new state should be, a one democratic state should be established on its places where we can have a normal life in this region. This apartheid state actually poses threat to the whole region and internationally as well. We can see that they are outreach as Africa or Eastern Europe. So the ramification of the existence of this colonial apartheid regime in this area is causing danger to the whole world.
Right.
Nonetheless, the region and Palestinians as well.
Okay. Kenneth, you know that Tel Aviv has put the air defense batteries on high alert and fearing rocket fire from the Palestinian side. Do you expect an escalation? And if that happens, how violent would it be this time around?
Well, I think the violence is there. The violence has never gone away. We can't really talk about escalation because on a daily basis, Palestinians are suffering and they're dying. And so in the way the framing of this in the media, particularly in some elements of the Western media, is as if these are just small explosions that happen and it's just a matter of getting the two sides together. that depiction is an entire lie. It's been a lie since 1948, and it's never stopped. And I think we have to get away from this notion that, you know, it's just a question of something happens, and then there's a reaction, and then another reaction. This has to be part of the analysis of the situation, the analysis of the creation of the state of Israel as an apartheid state, the function of its state, how it works internationally, how it relates economically to the United States. This is what we need to consider. Because if we're constantly going to be dealing with day-to-day aggressions and reactions, and whether that reaction is internal to Palestine, whether that's international, we're never going to move away from a circle of discussions and discussions. And I think that the shift towards the recognition by governments now, who are beginning to listen to their people, you know, things only change when people move. That's the history of the world. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen recently in terms of the issue of Palestine is that there's been a move from great sections of the international community, an interest in Palestine, and a determination to support Palestine. We also have to recognize the role of refugees, Palestinian refugees, who were forced from their land violently in 1948 onwards and had to go as refugees across the world. And they've settled in those countries. And those, the children of that generation are growing up and asking questions like, why can't I go home? They're in a position of power. They may be filmmakers, they may be models, they may be scientists. They are part of those societies, whether it's in Canada, the United States, or Europe. And now they're using their power to explain to the world that they are not satisfied with what's happened. They want the right of return. Their families want the right of return. And so the debate, I think, has to be shifted away from the violence. The violence has to stop. There should be intervention. Okay. There should be international intervention in the violence which Israel is using against the Palestinians. And this is long and long overdue. We all know that the reason this has been allowed, permitted, and actually encouraged is the United States and its need to control the Middle East for its own economic purposes. Okay. So this is the bigger picture.
Okay, and if you allow me, we have only 1 minute left. Let me put the one last question to Amal. Amal, with Naftali Bennett assuming the post of prime minister in the Tel Aviv regime, would you expect to see change in the Israeli policies vis-a-vis the Palestinians? We have only 1 minute.
No, of course not. As I said, the former and current governments are the same. They were in the same party, actually. They're part of the Likud party. So nothing is going to change for us. And the fact that four elections occurred in 2 years shows a lot, shows that this whole state is descending or is in a descending phase. The internal problems that they have, even within the right-wing Zionist parties, is incredible and is affecting the rest of their own people. So the demography is working against them. Palestinians in all of Palestine, historic Palestine, are exceeding in numbers. They're uniting together. The new generation of 1948, together with the West Bank, Gaza, and Jerusalem, are in one but fighting and resisting this okay. occupation in all means. The resistance in Gaza and the axis of resistance actually in the whole region are supporting the Palestinians. The international free people are also okay. on our side. So
unfortunately, I got to jump in. That's all the time we have. Sorry for
interrupting. The course of history is very...
Okay, and that's with that we should... I should appreciate the contribution made by our guests. We had Palestinian activists Amal Wahda and Ramallah, and Professor of Media Practice and Philosophy with Coventry University, Kenneth Ferro in London, with their contribution. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi.
This is IRIB English Radio. website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said on Monday, 14th of June, it was highly unlikely he would allow Joe Biden to fill a Supreme Court vacancy arising in 2024, the year of the next presidential election, if Republicans regain control of the chamber. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Martin Pingeli. The piece is titled, McConnell, Highly Unlikely I Would Let Biden Fill Supreme Court Seat in 2024. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said on Monday, 14th of June, it was highly unlikely he would allow Joe Biden to fill a Supreme Court vacancy arising in 2024, the year of the next presidential election, if Republicans regain control of the chamber. I think it's highly unlikely. In fact, no, I don't think either party, if it were different from the president, would confirm a Supreme Court nominee in the middle of an election year, McConnell told Hugh Hewitt, a conservative radio host. Mitch McConnell blocked Barack Obama from filling a vacancy in 2016, denying Merrick Garland, now Attorney General, even a hearing after he was nominated to fill the seat vacated by the death of Antonin Scalia. Mitch McConnell said that was because no new justice should be seated in an election year, a position he reversed with alacrity in 2020, on the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, 2 months before polling day. Ginsburg, a liberal lion, was replaced by the conservative Amy Coney Barrett, tipping the court 6-3 to the right. Major cases are coming up on abortion rights, on gun control, affirmative action, and much more. McConnell claimed then, and repeated to conservative radio host Hugh Hewitt, that no new justice should be seated in an election year, when the White House and the Senate are controlled by different parties. I think in the middle of a presidential election, McConnell said, if you have a Senate of the opposite party to the president, you have to go back all the way to the 1880s to find the last time a vacancy was filled. So I think it's highly unlikely. In fact, no, I don't think either party, if it controlled, if it were different from the president, would confirm a Supreme Court nominee in the middle of an election. What was different in 2020 was we were of the same party as the president. and that's why we went ahead with it. Ask what would happen if a vacancy arose in 2023 with Republicans in control of the Senate. Mitch McConnell said, "We have to wait and see what happens." He also said keeping Antonin Scalia's seat open to be filled under Donald Trump by Neil Gorsuch is the single most consequential thing I've done in my time as majority leader of the Senate. Mitch McConnell's hardball tactics have contributed to his status as a hate figure among progressives. On Monday, much online reaction to his remarks focused on beseeching Stephen Breyer, a liberal and at 82 years old, the oldest justice on the current Supreme Court, to retire while Joe Biden is in the White House and Democrats hold the Senate. Hassan, a professor of law and political science at the University of California at Irvine, said, "Exactly as I wrote last week, Mitch McConnell will not fill a Breyer seat if he's majority leader, even if he has to wait 2 years with the seat open." Jeet here, a columnist for The Nation magazine, wrote, "Can someone send this to USA Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer? Thanks." The conservative hold on the Supreme Court was strengthened in 2018 when Anthony Kennedy, often a swing vote on civil rights issues, stepped down and was replaced by Brett Kavanaugh, once an official in the White House of George W. Bush. Brett Kavanaugh faced and denied allegations of sexual assault during a stormy confirmation hearing, but Mitch McConnell said he was a strong candidate in his support and the process was duly completed. Breyer, appointed by Bill Clinton in 1994, has shown little inclination to follow Kennedy's example and step aside for a younger Supreme Court justice. Last month, he angered some on the left by telling high school and middle school students the key to working with conservatives was to talk to them more. Among progressives, support is growing for countering conservative dominance of the Supreme Court by increasing the number of justices. Republicans are strictly opposed to that. Mitch McConnell told Hewitt he wanted to give Breyer a shout out, though, because he joined what Justice Ginsburg said in 2019, that 9 is the right number for the Supreme Court, and I admire him for that. I think even the liberal justices on the Supreme Court have made it clear that court packing is a terrible idea. The number of justices on the Supreme Court is not fixed by America's Constitution.
From the heart of beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.